Hello, Capital Region. You may have just witnessed some technical difficulties, and if so, we're through them. Anyway, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith, and today we are discussing the New York State Association of Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Caucus that happened this past weekend.
We'll also be talking with New York-based activist Van Asher about harm reduction.
And afterwards, we'll hear from students of Darrow School on their Hudson River research findings.
And later, Professor Tamu Chambers of Hudson Valley Community College will explore the history and roots of hip-hop.
And finally, in part one of our series on the Climate and Community Protection Act, we'll hear the testimony of NYSERDA's Alicia Barton. But let's start the show off with some headlines.
For the second year in a row, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education has listed Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute as one of the 10 worst colleges for free speech. The foundation cited RPI's increasing hostility towards student action, the school's seizure of the previously student-run campus union, and other aggressive policing incidents. In February of 2018, for example, RPI security officers forcibly removed a group of students from the sidewalk outside of an RPI hockey game. The students had been handing out reading material on student union policy and Renew Rensselaer. Renew Rensselaer, an alumni group, opposes current campus president, Dr. Shirley Ann Jackson, on many issues. When questioned about the reasons for the cracking down on the group of students, university spokespeople offered conflicting, sometimes nonsensical reasons, ranging from eminent domain laws to lack of authorization for handing out reading materials. Eminent domain is, of course, not applicable, and school policy does not require permission for students to hand out materials.
In other local news, the Troy Boys and Girls Club hosted its first Books and Breakfast program this past Saturday. The program is meant to bring together people of all ages, races, and backgrounds for a morning of food, reading, and fun. The Capital District Intersectional Feminist Community Group, CDIF, organized the kickoff event with Hands Up! United co-founder Teff Poe, a local activist and artist. Families gathered at the Boys and Girls Club for a lovely breakfast, participated in arts projects, and were able to take books home in hopes of coming back next month to share their stories. The CDIF strives to open up conversations on important racial issues and more in a setting that allows people of all backgrounds to participate and share. They will be holding another event on March 16th at the Boys and Girls Club of Albany. Check them out on Facebook for more information about them and their events, or email them at cdif518@gmail.com to see what you can do to get involved.
On the national front, Donald Trump's allies have been attempting to defend the president's justification for invoking a state of emergency. Ohio Representative Jim Jordan took to ABC News this week to insist that Trump's claims regarding the state of emergency along the southern border were necessary. The show's host, Martha Raddatz, refuted Jordan by pointing out the decline in reported illegal border crossing in recent years, as well as noting that the long construction period required for the wall conflicted with an alleged state of emergency. Meanwhile, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham appeared on CBS News' Face the Nation and argued in favor of the emergency declaration. Graham stated that the funding cuts needed to build the wall were a necessary sacrifice. When questioned about cuts made to a Kentucky middle school, Graham stated that the kids would get the school they need when the border was secured. Meanwhile, on Fox News, Chris Wallace stumped senior Trump advisor Stephen Miller. Miller failed to name any other case in which a president had invoked a national emergency in reaction to failure to gain congressional approval for a proposal.
And ending our headlines on a more uplifting note, 17-year-old activist Winter Breanne partnered with Tom's Shoes in creating a gun violence prevention partnership that brought over 750,000 postcard requests for individual background checks to Congress. These background checks would require nearly all firearm sales in the United States to go through the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, as well as maintaining a record of the sales. The shoe brand had already pledged to donate $5 million towards organizations aimed at reducing and ending gun violence. This is what allowed Winter, an already active social justice seeker, to get involved with the creation of the Postcard Project, a landmark vote for the Bipartisan Background Checks Act of 2019 is scheduled for the end of this month.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM Troy and 98.9 FM Schenectady.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, please visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or heartwarming praise for your hosts, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley attended the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Caucus at the Capitol on February 16th. In this first segment, we hear from Assemblymember Felix Ortiz on election reform and divesting the state pension funds from fossil fuels. Also, Charles Barone on the need for revolution and Ron Deutsch on the Fiscal Policy Institute on how to meet the governor's projected revenue shortfall in the budget.
So we're at the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, and we're talking with Assemblymember Felix Ortiz, who, among other things, is promoting fair election reform in New York State. So, Assemblymember Ortiz, what are some of the key issues you'll be trying to raise?
Well, we will try to address that to make sure that we keep corporate money out of campaigning. Not just for elected officials at the local level, but also statewide. We will talk about the importances of probably using the matching fund formula, the same as what the city council doing in New York City. As you probably know, I had been working on legislation on the Clean Money, Clean Election Bill since 1996, which first I got introduced with David Patterson, Senator Patterson, and then the bill got introduced with former Senator Schneiderman, a bill that we thought that will be very critical and very important because that limit really $5 per constituents for people to support candidate. And I think in my own words, I believe that bill really is the bill to go. I think that matching fund, if that's the option, I think I would welcome that as well because that will also put limit on candidates. And I think it's about time now that we have a Democrat Senate and a Democrat Assembly and the Democrat governor that this should be the year where we finally pass legislation reforming our campaign finance system. And I'm looking forward to that because the winner of that will be our constituents, not corporate.
But what are some of the barriers, say, even to doing the clean money, clean election? Why can't we get money out of politics in New York?
Well, I think that the dynamic right now has changed. As you probably know, we never had a three-way Democrat since 1975. I think it's a lot of high expectation and it's big momentum from constituents that elected and turn around the Senate. They do have a very ambitious agenda, and one of them includes to make sure that we be able to reform campaign finance. And the reason has been very difficult is because we had a controlled Senate by Republicans, and these people cannot see the day where corporate money should not be part of any campaigning. So hopefully we're starting by closing the loophole 3 weeks ago. So this is a great step. I think that the big giant step will be when we really have a functional, credible campaign finance reform for all.
Last question. I know you're also the lead sponsor on the Let's Divest the State Pension Funds from Fossil Fuels. That's something that, unfortunately, State Controller Tom DiNapoli has not yet embraced. What do you think the prospects are, you know, for this session? What can people do?
Well, I think, first of all, what people should do is to continue to address this issue by sending emails, using social media, tackling the Speaker and the President of the Senate and the Governor. And also the members of the Environmental Committee. I think this is very important for them to understand the need of disinvesting fossil fuel money from the pension plan. And it's not going to hurt nobody. This is something that will help the environment, will help our community, our neighborhood. And one of the biggest obstacles in reality is that the people have no clear understanding on how this disinvestment works. If they don't, they probably are not reading the right papers, because we have been very vocal, and also we have sent a lot of information to the chair and others to have a better understanding about why this is so important and why New York should take the lead. New York should not be a follower. New York needs to continue to be a lead, and I hope continuously working with Senator Krueger in the Senate and myself, who we've been doing this for many years now. Hopefully this year we might see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Assemblymember Felix Ortiz. So we're talking with Assemblymember Charles Barron, who's at the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, doing a workshop on revolution and reform. What are some of the points you're going to be making today to the crowd?
Well, first, there's a fundamental difference between reform and revolution. I believe that we live under a fatally flawed, parasitic, predatory capitalist system. That is at the root of all our problems. So if we just deal with trying to reform capitalism, which I think is not reformable, if that's a word, not redeemable, I don't think that we can fix it up. I think we need to go through fundamental change that Martin Luther King called for. He was once talking about civil rights. He died talking about human rights and a radical reorganization of the entire society, because he failed to reform. He tried to register people to vote. He was murdered. He tried to get people to sit at the same lunch counter with whites. After he succeeded at that, they didn't even have the money to buy the lunch. So reform should be used as a strategy, a tactic for inevitable radical revolutionary change of the system.
So within the context of the New York State Legislature, how does one promote a revolution?
Well, you get to policies like free health care for all, free education for all. Then you go through systemic change. We need to change how the budget process goes. We need to change how people are determining which communities get what. So after you have a legislative process, because that whole process is a reformist process, you have to get to structural change, systemic change, and not just reacting to the symptoms of capitalism, but the system of capitalism. And that's why I'm here in this legislative body. I can talk about it here, plant the seeds of revolution in the minds of people, while at the same time I'm in the seat of power to deliver housing, to deliver youth centers, to deliver jobs, and say, now that you've got housing, youth centers, and jobs, let's talk about changing the whole system. See, it's one thing to say that I gave a beggar or somebody on the streets some money to buy a dinner. It's another thing to say, I'm going to change the system that's causing him to beg in the first place.
One last question. So obviously one of the big issues right now has been climate change. Some people, like your old comrade Howie Hawkins, pushing for public ownership of energy, democratic control. You know, what are some of the things you would think that we could do as a revolution in terms of trying to deal with the climate change?
Well, I agree with Howie, 100% public control of the whole climate change issue. I think we need to go to fossil, get rid of the fossil fuels, and go to solar energy, geothermal energy, the energy from the earth, wind energy, and hydro, water. Those energy sources, I think, would reduce the carbon count. And so when the rays that come in from the sun enter the earth, and then they flee back through the atmosphere to go back out, they get trapped because of the carbon buildup around their exit out. So I think that we need to look at those new energy resources that are cleaner, affordable, and renewable.
Assemblymember Charles Barron. We're talking with Ron Deutsch of the Fiscal Policy Institute. The governor recently announced that we have a multi-billion-dollar budget deficit, and instead of raising taxes on the wealthy, he seems to be, let's cut taxes on or cut funding for programs like Medicaid. What does the Fiscal Policy Institute think about what our revenue strategy should be in this year's state budget?
Well, I think a number of things. Certainly, if we're short on revenue, we should look at different ways to generate more revenue in order to meet the demand rather than continuing to cut services. And I also think that, you know, the governor's self-imposed 2% state spending cap is going to result in, you know, yet more cuts to critical human services across the state. So I think there's a lot that we can do. And one of the things we should be doing right now is realigning our priorities on spending. And $10 billion a year on economic development is probably a bit too much given all the scandals, corruption, and convictions that we've seen over the course of the last year.
Now, the millionaire's tax apparently is going to be extended. Any possibility is going to be expanded?
Well, we've certainly been pushing for expansion. This week, we had the patriotic millionaires come to Albany and basically say, tax us more. They're not going to leave the state if they have to pay an additional half or 1% in increased income taxes. So I think that the money is out there. We're one of the richest states in this country, and we have the greatest income inequality of any state in the country. So we need to go after the money for where it is. As Willie Horton said, you know, he robbed banks because that's where the money is. If we need revenue, then we should go to the folks that have, you know, basically seen all the income gains over the last two decades.
And that's been Ron Deutsch of Fiscal Policy Institute. This is Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And again, that was Mark Dunley from this past weekend, part one of the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Caucus.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. For our next segment, we have Hudson Mohawk Magazine coordinator Corinne Carey. Corinne spoke recently with Van Asher, manager of Harm Reduction Services and Syringe Access Program of the St. Anne's Corner of Harm Reduction in Lower East Side Manhattan. Van Asher has applied innovative techniques to harm and overdose reduction at St. Anne's.
My name is Van Asher. I am the Harm Reduction Services and Syringe Access Program Manager at St. Anne's Corner of Harm Reduction, which is a syringe exchange program in the South Bronx.
And how many people utilize the services of the organization?
Last year, there were 8,000 participants that accessed our services.
St. Anne's Corner of Harm Reduction is one of the oldest harm reduction programs in the country.
Correct. We opened our doors a little over 28 years ago.
How long have you been in harm reduction yourself?
I started working in harm reduction a little over 26 years ago.
What kind of changes have you seen?
Initially, we were seeing people getting sick and dying from HIV. And now we're seeing people dying at even more alarming rates, but from fatal overdose. But there's no longer the preparation of seeing someone and knowing that they have, which at the time was a terminal illness, and having some sort of preparation. Now you see someone and you're like, oh, I'll see you later, and you never see them again.
We hear a lot of talk in the media about an opioid epidemic and an overdose epidemic. Sometimes those terms are used a little too loosely. Are we in the middle of an epidemic?
Yes and no. Yes, we have been for a very long time. They're talking about it as if it's something new. Over the last decade, accidental overdose has been the number two killer of Latinos and African Americans in New York. But since white people that look like me started dying at increasing rates, all of a sudden it was labeled an epidemic, which is reminiscent of what we saw with HIV when white middle class heterosexual America began getting infected. We labeled this an epidemic. When white middle class heterosexual America began getting anything, we label it an epidemic. And a lot of these things can be prevented but aren't, and turn into epidemics as a result of endemic neglect. We end up where we are.
Local police departments and EMTs now carry Narcan. That's relatively recent. More recent is, you know, school nurses that carry Narcan. How long has Narcan been a tool used to reverse and address overdose?
Well, Narcan actually is a brand name. The drug itself is called Naloxone, which is an opioid blocker. And it's been used for years in surgery where anesthesiologists will administer it because they accidentally overdose people when they put them under all the time. It started being used to reverse overdoses. Paramedics first had access to it, but non-medical personnel were not allowed to have it. Dan Bigg, who was from the Chicago Recovery Alliance, started giving out illegally and really made it accessible. Any syringe exchange program that has access to it, it's largely responsible to him. And he threw the rock in the puddle that caused the giant ripple that saved tens of thousands of lives.
The Chicago Recovery Alliance is a harm reduction program, kind of like St. Anne's Corner.
Exactly the same.
How long did it take for that intervention of putting naloxone in the hands of users? How long did it take for that to become mainstream?
It took a very long time. Naloxone in New York became legal to access without a prescription in April of 2006, but you had to have a prescription. So it really hasn't been until the last few years that it's really been readily available to get into the hands of people that are using drugs on the street.
And why is it important for people who use drugs to have it as opposed to a service provider?
Well, oftentimes people are afraid to call for help.
What's the hesitation to call 911?
If you call 911, especially if you say it's an overdose, oftentimes the police will show up. And what has historically happened, let's say I was doing drugs with someone and that person overdosed and their overdose was fatal, I could be charged with their death because sharing drugs in New York State constitutes a drug sale. So Puff Puff Pass is really a drug sale because it's how we trump up numbers on the war on drugs, which is a war against an invisible enemy, which is really a war on people of color and the poor. That's reason enough not to call for help.
Plus, you might not be in a place where someone can come to help.
Exactly, or might not get there in time.
So it's really great to see the proliferation of naloxone, but you've been doing something even more innovative to address the overdose crisis. What is that?
One of the initiatives I came up with, which is now being used across the country, was using urine fentanyl drug test strips so someone could test their drugs prior to ingestion, whether they're sniffing, snorting, or injecting their substances, to determine if there's fentanyl present. Unfortunately, they don't discern the amount of fentanyl present, but my thought was an educated consumer is an empowered consumer, and with the knowledge that there is fentanyl in your substances, you can possibly use differently.
What's fentanyl?
Well, fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that's actually used as a cancer drug. It's a great drug, but illicitly manufactured, it's 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. And when it's mixed in to the drug supply on the street, since there's no quality control, it's what's responsible for 57% of the fatal overdoses in New York last year.
How did that happen and why?
Sale of drugs is a business. And fentanyl is cheap. If I could get a kilo of fentanyl for a couple of grand, or I could get a kilo of heroin, which will cost like 40 grand and make significantly less money, why would I do that?
And so that's why we're seeing drug dealers or drug operations cutting heroin with fentanyl, because it's cheaper, it's sort of giving the heroin super strength.
Yeah, and fentanyl has a harder hit, but it has shorter legs, so it doesn't last as long. So this is doing two things. One, it hits you harder, but two, it doesn't last as long.
Is it appealing to a drug user on the street that a batch of heroin may be cut with fentanyl?
I'm not sure if appealing is necessarily the right word.
Well, I remember when you and I worked at the Lower East Side Needle Exchange, and there was a blackboard, and staff from the Needle Exchange would put up the names of batches of heroin that were sold on the street in the little white bags, and they'd be stamped with a brand. Mm-hmm. And if a brand was known to cause a number of overdoses, that brand would go up on the blackboard.
Yes.
And it had the perverse effect of having people go and seek out that batch because it was stronger.
From the drugs that we've been testing in the Bronx, the majority of opiates people have brought in and asked me to test residue, the majority of them are testing positive for fentanyl. So there's more fentanyl being found than heroin. And we've also tested to see if there was heroin. And heroin was found in some, but a lot of them were just finding fentanyl.
So some people go out to purchase heroin and they're coming back with pure fentanyl.
Yeah.
What led you to start thinking about putting the tools into users' hands to figure out what was in their drugs?
My college girlfriend's best friend's boyfriend had gotten sentenced for trafficking cocaine, and he lives in Falmouth and was sent to spend and do his time in Brooklyn. I went to visit him every Friday because his family couldn't come down, and we became friendly. And when he was released, he went back to Falmouth and began managing these 2 3-quarter houses, and he was having someone come and do naloxone trainings there, because he knows that people in 3-quarter houses use drugs. He was telling me that a lot of the blue-collar workers were seeking out fentanyl because they were being drug tested in order to have the better-paying jobs where you'd work on the mansions.
As plumbers, electricians.
Sheetrockers, right. Electricians, exactly. And there was a time I'd left Syringe Exchange and was doing environmental activism, and I was working in a biodiesel company. And one of the things I had to do was I'd get a list of drivers from the DOT that would have to get urine tested quarterly. And if I wanted to add a drug to the list of drugs they're going to be tested for, it was very expensive. But I'm also an epileptic, and so I test my urine to see if I'm in ketosis. My neurologist put me on a high keto diet, which has allowed me to lower my epilepsy dose. But I check by peeing on a urine test strip. And I was like, I'm sure there's got to be urine test strips for fentanyl because there are other drug test strips for it. And I did an internet search and I found this company, BTNX, that had them. And then I did a little more research and I found that there was a pilot study in Vancouver with Insight, which is a safe injection site, where they'd done a study with 700 of the strips. And so I contacted someone there and spoke to them. Then I contacted BTNX and spoke with them and started ordering strips. The Department of Health had just given our program, that we're doing an expansion, and part B, they wanted us to do something creative and innovative. And so I'd suggested to our executive director, Joyce Rivera, this is how I wanted to spend some of the money, was on teaching people how to test their drugs for fentanyl prior to ingestion. You can use it whether you're snorting, shooting, or sniffing. If your drugs are in pill form, you can crush them and test them.
What are you hoping people do with that information?
Well, I hope people will use with friends, will take turns, will carry naloxone, will go slow. So let's say I was injecting something, I had my shot drawn up, I'd push in a very little first. Especially if I knew there was fentanyl in it. If I knew there was fentanyl in it, maybe I'll split the shot. I'll squeeze half of the shot back into another sterile syringe and save that for later. And as I'm injecting, inject a little and keep the syringe in my arm, wait for a minute and see how it feels, and maybe then squeeze a little more.
Are people doing that?
I think people's use has changed. There's other studies that have shown that people are beginning to change their drug use based on the determining factors of these tests.
So if I were a drug user in the capital region, 3 hours north of here, where there aren't as many syringe exchange programs, what would your advice be?
I would say contact your local Department of Health and say, hey, New York City's Department of Health is paying for these. Do you know of any users' unions where I could access these, or any harm reduction centers nearby? And if not, could you provide them for a local users union and see about maybe putting something together?
How are you getting the word out about this?
Oh, I've spoken at conferences. I've done a bunch of interviews. I've put together an animated video that shows how to use them that's very descriptive, because the test strips, one line is positive. And I think it's really important to have something visual, and I'm in the works of translating it to Spanish, because HIV and Hep C and STI testing, one line is negative. So people are so used to seeing one line and thinking, oh, one line is negative, where in this scenario, one line is positive.
So what's the title of the YouTube video?
The title of the YouTube video is Using Urine Drug Test Strips as a Harm Reduction Tool.
There's so much more to say about drugs, drug users, and how to prevent harm. We're going to have to continue this in a part 2.
Definitely. That'd be my pleasure.
And that was media correspondent Corinne Carey interviewing Van Asher of St. Anne's Corner of Harm Reduction in part one of our Reduction Innovation series.
For those just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Dave Pueblo. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to split an atom to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a collection of rare wasps, the flying kind, you can text us at 518-888-3004. And also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Now let's hear from students of educator and activist Leah Penniman from the Darrow School at New Lebanon, New York, on their research of PCB pollution in the Hudson River.
This is Leah Penniman, science teacher at the Darrow School in New Lebanon, New York, here with my students, Akos, Jade, and Jada, who are getting ready to share their research and findings on our beloved Hudson River.
Hello, this is Jade.
Akosa.
And Jada.
And today we are coming to talk about the Hudson River from the small environmental science class at Darrow School. Today we are talking about the PVC pollution in the Hudson River. PVC pollution causes great harm, not only to the animal marine life, but also the humans and the environment around it.
Jade, what exactly is PCB?
PCB, or polychlorinated biphenyls, are a class of chemicals consisting of 209 individual compounds. PVC were widely used as a fire preventive and insulator in the manufacture of transformers and capacitors because of their ability to withstand exceptionally high temperatures.
What Jade is trying to say is that PCB is a bunch of chemicals that are used in machines and factories.
But when did PCBs get introduced into the Hudson River, Jada?
In 1977, there were about 1.3 million pounds of PCB in the Hudson River. General Electric capacitor manufacturing plants located in Fort Edward and Hudson Falls, New York, were what caused the many PCBs in the waters. Long distances of PCB have been found in snow and seawater in areas far from where they were released into the environment, but they are also all over the world. Let me tell you a short story. Scientists have been doing research since the early 1970s. PCB is found from Hudson Falls to New York City. People from the Superfund research program conducted studies from the lower Hudson River to test its waters. They found there to be pollutants, including PCB, in the water, which is bad for the fish. Fishermen were taking these fish and bringing them to eat for their families. According to SRP, more people are to have PCB by fish and shellfish because of the high levels of PCB.
Do you guys want to hear a joke?
Sure.
What is the difference between pollution and solution?
What?
If a politician drowns in a river, it's pollution. And if all of them drown, then it's a solution.
I don't get it.
Never mind.
Anyways, the main question is, how does PCB affect the Hudson River? Well, in 1976, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, the NYSDEC, stopped fishing in the upper Hudson River, where more PCB levels were found. The PCB in the river was affecting the fish, and which affected us because, well, we eat the fish. And how is PCB harmful to humans, of course?
PCBs are a carcinogen and extremely damaging to us and the ecosystem. Some mixtures of PCBs are more likely to cause cancers than others.
What? Cancer? If PCB can cause cancer, what else can it cause?
PCBs causes developmental effects. For example, women exposed to PCBs before or during pregnancies can give birth to children with significant neurological and motor control problems, lowered IQ, and poor short-term memory. A group of children in Michigan whose mothers had been exposed to PCBs were found to have decreased birth weight and head size, lowered performance on standardized memory, psychomotor and behavioral tests, and lower IQ. These effects lasted through at least 7 years.
After giving you all these facts, you may ask yourself, well, how do I steer clear from the PCB? Well, you can start with the fish you are consuming.
All in all, cooking fish that have been consumed by PCB does not clear all the toxins from the fish. Frying and microwaving does not help to relieve PCB, but boiling or baking can help to leave PCBs, especially in the fish fat where PCB is stored in. Some fish that are not good to consume in the lower Hudson River are walleye, white catfish, channel catfish, American eel, gizzard shad, and more.
What about grilling fishes?
grilling fish can actually reduce the amount of PCB in the fat of fish.
That's awful. Thank you for listening.
This is Leah Penniman, science teacher at the Darrow School. You just heard from students. Akos, Jade, and Jada share their opinion on the Hudson River.
And now we move on to an interview from Hudson Valley Community College professor Tamu Chambers. Professor Chambers explores the roots and history of hip-hop and shares the experience of working with rapper Curtis Mitchell to create music from the sounds of her students' zipping bags.
Hello, everyone. I'm Professor Tamu Chambers, and it's a pleasure to share with you information about Black History Month. The first segment, we look at history and the emergence of hip-hop or rap as a distinct urban-based expressive culture that speaks to the alienation, isolation, and abandonment of Black youth in America's cities. It is such a pleasure to introduce rapper Curtis Mitchell. Curtis spelled with a double S. During the African American history class in fall of 2018, Curtis assisted in a rap dream that I had for a few years, and that was to capture the tone and tenure of students zipping their packed bags at the end of class. I recall Curtis's smile as he leaned closer in his seat and said that as a rapper, he's interested. Excitingly and enthusiastically, I wrote lyrics explaining the significance of students zipping their bags as a sign of eagerly preparing for their next class. And Curtis volunteered to bring his instruments to the college, and in the lower level of the library commons of HVCC, he had the skill set of creating the beats, the rhythm in producing the zip, zip, zip song, and his amazing voice greatly enhanced the rap. And the video continues to receive accolades from faculty, staff, and students. And others describe the video as an organic presentation of cultural diversity. So Curtis, as a rapper and college student, what are your experiences in understanding the significance of rap or hip hop? And is there a difference between the two?
I say there's a slight difference between the two. I feel like rap is what you're doing, but hip hop is like what you're standing for. Experiences and understanding the significance of it, it's just like there's stories that need to be told. The people who make it mainstream get to tell their own personal stories, as well as other people from like their communities that couldn't tell their story. I feel like I have a story to tell too, and I want the world to know my story.
How would you connect the African griots or the African practitioners of oral tradition?
Well, the African griots, you know, hip-hop wouldn't exist without them. Even though hip-hop, like, sort of originated in New York, way before then they had the people, the spiritual days, the Underground Railroad days, like, it all started from that. And, you know, one thing led to another, and today we have hip-hop, and I think it's kind of transformed from back in the old days to now. And, you know, nothing stays the same, so there's always constant change. You know, we have different styles of hip-hop. We have, like, you got slow pace, you got educational hip-hop, you even got, like, teachers and students, like, doing hip-hop. You know, hip-hop has just spread, like, across, like, everywhere. I think the griots laid down that foundation.
What is your goal as a young rapper?
My goal as a young rapper, you know, is to make it, obviously, like anybody else. And I want to make it on my own. I don't want to sign to no major labels or anything. I want to stay independent. Everything that I earn, I want to be able to keep it for myself and not like, have to break money with the labels. Or, you know, I want everything independent. You know, nobody's taking from me a percentage of what I'm making already, you know. I want to be able to earn everything I earn and then disperse of it correctly. And the personal relationship with hip-hop is my cousin. He was a hip-hop, you know, monster. Like, he the one that started me. And I used to be in my aunt's house, you know. He used to be just writing in his notebook. And he's like, Curtis, you know, try to do something. Let me see what you have. And, you know, I had like a little notepad and I just wrote like 4 or 5 words. And basically he was like, yo, bro, just keep doing that, bro, you get better. And he had gotten to a traumatic situation, so he's like his focus on hip hop like kind of perished. So, you know, it came to me. So I think I'm gonna just take his dream and our dream and, you know, just try to take it as far as I can.
What do you think one of the reasons that so many young white students have also gravitated towards rap? For example, I see some students and they'll have Tupac Shakur's tattoo and or even on their computer screen, I'll see students with a picture of him.
Yeah.
So what do you think that attraction is?
Hip-hop spreads. It doesn't have a limit. It can go anywhere. It just spreads throughout everybody. And, you know, it's not meant for one group of people. It's meant for everybody, young, old, in the middle. It has, like, no discrimination. It's for everybody. So people that are other colors and other races, they can still relate. They can still be entertained by it. It's not always being relatable. But, you know, some people entertain it, you know. They like the stories that people tell.
I think that's what I was listening for, is the stories.
The stories
that they tell. Also motivates the young group. Americans in the 1970s, which consists of stylizing rhythmic music that commonly accompanies rap. Mm-hmm. So do you think with the music and then also the other things and how it motivates individuals to want to dance, starting out with the break dancing, for example, then as it continues to flourish?
Yeah, you know, music, it opens up a lot of doors, you know. It gets up and make people want to dance, and it gets up and it might make somebody want to cry. It's all about what you need in your life or what you want to hear, what type of music. And like I said, hip-hop is everything. Hip-hop can be sad music. Hip-hop can be like club turn-up music, or hip-hop can just be storytelling. Every human likes one of those things, whether they like the storytelling, the turn-up, or the club music, just to listen to it, just to like it. It applies to everybody. It's just which one applies, you know?
How do you determine your beats? I've always been, you know, like impressed with that. I mean, for example, when you were able to put the beats to the hip-hop song, to really make it come alive, and as you know, with any genre or with any message, that is extremely important with the interconnectedness of both.
That part's the easy part. It's basically like just having like an ear for the music. Know what you looking for, know what you're hearing for, listening for. And it's also what you like, you know. Everybody's not gonna like every song. You know, it's all about what you like. And if you like it, just put your all into it. And then, you know, there's always gonna be negative and positive feedback out of every song, album done.
So. What about the gangster rap? Because as you know, that has had a negative impact, and also many people criticize the language.
The language, it's just a form of expression. Everybody in the world uses vulgar language. It's just put behind instruments. It's not even the vulgar language, it's like how it's being used. You could use it in a fun way, disrespectful way, or you could like use it in a song, but then again, it's like whether the person is going to take it the wrong way or not. And it's simply just an expression. You know, if you're in a sad song, you might say some sad things or relate a curse word to a sad situation. Or if you, the opposite, you know, you in like a club environment, you got the curse words for that type of environment. So, you know, it's just music. It's just how you interpret it. And everybody might not like it.
Okay, but the issue with the gangster rap, where is that today?
They think like gangster rap promotes violence. I can't say that it doesn't, but you know, most of the gangster rap is people basically telling their story. That used to be, because people that were gangsters turned into rappers. You see what I'm saying? So they just talking about the past, and you know, that's all they know. That's what they're a product of the environment. They grew up in a bad situation. That's all they know, so that's what they're going to tell. Most of it's real, some of it's not, but then it's a story behind it, and then it's also entertainment. So you can't really take it too serious, because if it was real, if they were really talking about things that's going on currently, people will be behind bars. So it's most of it's entertainment to the young community.
Rap today, or in the 21st century, what are some of the suggestions that you might want to give to youth? Because everyone, or many in the African-American community, that's their dream, to want to become a rapper. Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to them, and how successful do you think that rap will continue to flourish today in our society?
I feel like rap will be around forever. Music will be around forever. So that's just one of the things that's like never going to leave. And to the young community, to the young people that want to pursue music, you just got to be dedicated. Eddie Murphy once said, people have a dream or have a goal, but then they think about the possibility of failing. And once they start thinking about that possibility of failing, they'll never make it because they're always thinking about failing. And Eddie Murphy said, basically, if you just chase your goal and just look at it and don't look back, 9 times out of 10, you're going to make it because you didn't even think about failing. So it wasn't around you. It wasn't concerning you, bothering you. And, you know, most people, if you're good at what you do and you work hard at what you do, you'll be happy with what you did. You'll be happy with the outcome, knowing that you gave it your all.
Okay. Well, Curtis, thank you so much, and specifically for that inspirational message at the end. And I will always continue to wish you the best, and I can't wait to hear more of your music.
Thank you, Professor.
Knowledge.
Appreciate that.
The power. Professor Chambers, she a teacher, not a preacher. She'll do anything.
That was HVCC Professor Tamu Chamber and rapper Curtis Mitchell on The Power, Meaning, and Roots of Hip-Hop Music. And last week, the State Senate held public hearings on Governor Cuomo's Green New Deal and the Climate Leadership Act. Now we'll hear the testimony of Alicia Barton, President and CEO of the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, from the public hearing in Albany on February 12th.
For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. In this first segment of our coverage of the public hearings on the Climate and Community Protection Act, we'll hear the testimony of Alicia Barton, CEO of New York State Energy Research and Development Authority.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to this first ever hearing on climate change and the Climate and Community Protection Act. I'm State Senator Todd Kaminsky, Chair of the Senate's Committee on Environmental Conservation. And I'm proud to be joined by my counterpart, Assemblyman Steve Englebright, who's the chair of the respective assembly committee, because I think this is a groundbreaking piece of legislation that really is the chance to set New York as a leader in our country when it comes to combating climate change. And it is also transforming of our entire economy, which is not something we take lightly or going to rush to do without having thinking it through. I want to welcome our first witness, who is Alicia Barton, president, a CEO of NYSERDA.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Kaminsky and members of the committee. I am Alicia Barton, President and CEO of the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA. I commend the committee members and other legislative leaders for taking up the discussion of climate-focused legislation, a clear signal that here in New York, public policy is informed by science. The discussion here today is not whether to act, but how best to act to achieve our shared goals. Governor Cuomo's Green New Deal and the Climate Leadership Act, included in the governor's state budget proposal, lay out a sweeping plan that can deliver the carbon reductions we need to safeguard our communities and our planet within a cost-effective framework that will provide flexibility to avoid unintended economic harm. The Climate Leadership Act would codify and build upon much of the progress made by the state so far, including a requirement for a 100% carbon-free power sector by 2040 and increasing the state's successful clean energy standard to 70% renewable energy by 2030. These are the most aggressive renewable energy targets in the nation, and they will create the backbone for a carbon-neutral economy. We know that smart policies can accelerate the cost declines of renewables and put these ambitious standards well within reach. In just the last 2 years, New York has awarded $2.9 billion in contracts to 46 large-scale wind and solar projects that will generate $7 billion in direct investment in the clean energy sector. The contract prices in the most recent solicitation were 23% lower than the bids received only just 2 years ago. NYSERDA's New York Sun program has spurred an increase of nearly 1,500% in installed solar energy. At the same time, costs to install solar have already been reduced by half. Today, New York has emerged as one of the largest national markets for distributed solar energy. We anticipate that new wind and solar installations under the clean energy standard will more than double by 2030. The target for distributed solar deployment in New York is doubling to 6,000 megawatts by 2025. And we will expand the Solar for All program to ensure access to solar for low and moderate income New Yorkers. The state's energy storage target of 3,000 megawatts by 2030 ensures that we can build a more flexible and more resilient electric grid as we march to 100% clean electricity. We are also making great strides to reduce overall energy consumption by roughly doubling the level of energy efficiency achievement in the state by 2025, a move that will ensure affordability as we shift to a renewable portfolio. Additionally, the governor's 9,000 megawatt offshore wind target is the most aggressive offshore wind goal in U.S. history, more than the total combined offshore wind targets of the other Northeast states. This will truly transform the state's electricity system, serving almost 30% of the state's total expected electricity need in 2035, and it will capitalize on the opportunity to become the U.S. hub for the emerging offshore wind industry. We have already seen record interest from the world's leading offshore wind companies in the New York market and expect to award the first contracts later this year. Governor Cuomo's plan also includes investing up to $200 million in New York port infrastructure to match private sector investment in regional development of offshore wind and to maximize the long-term economic benefits to the state, including good-paying jobs in this burgeoning industry. The governor is proposing codifying the Environmental Justice and Just Transition Working Group and incorporating it into the planning process. The governor is also directing the state's low-income energy task force to identify reforms to achieve greater impact of the public energy funds expended each year, such as the $700 million in funds spent each year for bill assistance. The governor's plan goes farther than ever in supporting New York workers by including requirements for prevailing wage under the large-scale renewable energy solicitations and requiring provisions for project labor agreements within offshore wind procurements. I am pleased to report that New York is already home to nearly 152,000 clean energy jobs and that this sector is growing at double the statewide average employment growth rate. And under the governor's plan, we believe New York State has the opportunity to spur the creation of over 100,000 new good-paying clean energy jobs. The Green New Deal calls for the creation of a Climate Action Council comprised of experts that will bring together critical components and examine the costs and benefits of respective approaches to allow consideration of regional solutions, to ensure considerations of economic competitiveness, and to develop a detailed roadmap to a carbon neutral economy. This roadmap will include a net zero carbon roadmap for buildings, and it will evaluate the policy mechanisms to reduce emissions in the transportation sector. The Climate Leadership Act would solidify New York's role as a national and global leader and pave the way for the creation of a thriving new clean energy economy while preserving affordability and reliability.
Senator Salazar?
You mentioned increasing the state's successful clean energy standard to 70% renewable energy by 2030. How does that compare to the current clean energy standard?
So the current clean energy standard was put in place a couple years ago, and it set a target of 50% renewable energy by 2030. The governor's proposal would increase that to 70% by 2030, founded upon the track record of what we've seen so far in those couple years since the policy was put in place. I referenced the $2.9 billion in new contracts for large-scale wind and solar. It's not an understatement to say we had an unprecedented response to those first two solicitations, and the response really made clear that we can procure substantial amounts of new renewable electricity at lower cost than we originally projected.
The bill specifically targets other sectors than the electric generation sector. In light of your perch, how would you advise us to go about thinking about how we should be addressing those other sectors and whether we should pursue caps on those sectors or carbon neutrality in those sectors the same way we're both doing respectively within the electric generation sector?
Well, we absolutely agree that action to reduce emissions outside of the electric sector is needed, and that is part of the governor's proposal. The proposal he has made sets the 100% clean electricity standard by 2040, but also directs the Climate Action Council to develop a roadmap to a carbon neutral economy. I think the way to think about it, or that I would encourage committee members to think about it, however, is our efforts are much more mature in the electric sector. We already are seeing a tremendous amount of momentum and progress that informs a much more detailed view of time horizons and costs that could be implicated in accelerating to those higher renewable and 100% clean electricity standards. There's additional work to be done, I believe, in undertaking similar analysis and monitoring market trends and, frankly, pushing the markets to advance more quickly than they have in the past in things like building decarbonization or building electrification and emissions reduction in the transportation sector. Those questions are critically important, but they're also complex, and they bear a lot of consideration, which is why the governor proposed to put a council of experts in charge of developing a roadmap to tackle those challenges.
Senator Cameron, you have a question?
Why wouldn't we, instead of enacting law to require sort of a third-party entity to develop policy around this, instead use the legislative process during the course of this session and come up with some standards we could actually enact in over the next 4 months or so.
This came directly out of the IPCC report from last fall that I think really opened a lot of people's eyes on these issues. There is no historic precedent for the magnitude of changes that are necessary to combat climate change and to achieve the levels of greenhouse gas reduction that we're talking about. But the good news is that we have been making progress faster than we thought just a few years ago. The cost declines that I cited in my testimony are good evidence of the fact that these are very dynamic markets, and technology has been breaking our way and costs have been breaking our way. But it is a playing field that shifts rapidly. So even a few years ago, I don't think we would have foreseen the incredible cost declines we've seen for certain technologies like offshore wind. And I think that we have every reason to hope that we will see those same transformations take place in transportation and in the building sector. But we are in earlier stages of seeing those markets develop. And I do think it's prudent to take an approach where we can monitor those trends closely and in a place where we allow the most cost-effective portfolio of approaches to come forward rather than locking into certain requirements at the beginning when we know, again, that we're likely to see technology and cost change in ways that we probably don't know sitting here today.
The working group the governor would be mandating would report back to the governor and the legislature. Can you talk about the time framing of that work as is anticipated by the governor's?
The governor's proposal, if enacted, would call upon the council to start their work immediately and to report within a year on their findings and the roadmap to a carbon neutral economy. Given where we are today, that doubling down and accelerating quickly in the electric sector is something that we believe is technologically reasonable, cost-effective.
Other countries have standards that are more ambitious than that, right?
I believe there are some other countries that may have that, but, you know, New York is, I believe, the 13th largest economy in the world. We are up there, I would say, again, not only nationally, but globally in terms of the level of ambition of what the governor's proposal has put forward.
I think with respect to the electricity sector, I think that we would acknowledge that it's ambitious, perhaps not. Perhaps it doesn't get us where we need to be, you know, as a state or as a planet. The current trajectory of climate change, what's known now and well documented, aren't things going to be worse a year from now than they are now?
Well, unfortunately, I do believe things are getting worse every year. That's what we are seeing and what the science is telling us. I just want to make sure I don't leave any ambiguity that we are also doing a tremendous amount of work today in sectors outside the electric sector to decarbonize. We have aggressive program offerings and goals related to things like building electrification. We have been deploying records amounts of funding for electric vehicle incentives and the like, recognizing that it is going to take us a little bit of time to continue to advance those sectors to the point where we are on the electric side.
To summarize Ms. Barton's testimony, there are many economic indicators which suggest the momentum built by New York's current carbon reduction efforts could carry the state through a successful zero-emission energy transition. She mentioned the rapidly falling costs of solar and wind technology and the promising job growth clean energy offers. Investment in solar and wind is already seeing returns of double or more, and hopefully the cost of new technology in other sectors will fall in course. As well, she outlined funding that will be utilized to reduce green energy costs for moderate and low-income communities. Still, the proposal leaves many challenges to be addressed. The sheer magnitude of mobilization required to tackle climate change leaves lawmakers without precedent to guide policies. And while New York has made promising strides in green energy, there are as of yet no guidelines for reducing emissions outside of the electricity sector. Technology, and especially financial incentives, in categories like transportation and heating are not yet developed enough to set feasible goals. Finally, the proposal is not as ambitious compared to the efforts of other countries. You can read the governor's proposal and watch the public hearing in full at nysenate.gov. And if you have something to add, the Senate allows 120 days for the submission of public comment. In our upcoming segments, we'll hear testimonies that claim the governor's Green New Deal goes too far in burdening New York State businesses, plus those that say the bill doesn't go far enough to consider resources and methods of carbon reduction which are already available to New York. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm not Dave.
And I'm not Alexis. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org.